A recent headline blared, labor shortages end when wages rise. Gosh, Captain Obvious, what an amazing discovery. Someone notify the Nobel Prize Committee, for surely this revolutionary revelation will win this year's prize in economics. Better yet, someone notify that gaggle of Republican governors whose theory of labor economics begins and ends with a medieval demand that workers be whacked with a stick to make them do what the bosses want. At issue is the furious complaint by restaurant chains, nursing homes, Big Ag, and other low-wage employers that they have a critical labor shortage. It seems that millions of workers today are hesitant to take jobs because there's no affordable child care, or the jobs they're offered expose them and their families to COVID-19, or the work itself is abusive and demeaning, or all of the above. Business chieftains wail that they've been advertising thousands of jobs for waiters, poultry workers, nursing assistants, and such, but they can't get enough takers. So corporate-serving governors have rushed to their rescue. Shouting, "Whack 'em with a stick!" these mingy politicians are stripping away jobless benefits, trying to force workers to take any crappy job they're offered. It gives new meaning to the term workforce. But wait, there's an honest way to get the workers they need. Offer fair wages. As the owner of a small chain of restaurants in Atlanta notes, when he stopped lowballing wages, he not only got the workers he needed, but we started to get a better quality of applicants. That translated to better service, happier customers, and more business. This is Jim Hightower saying, if you treat employees as cheap, that's what you'll get. But if you view them as valuable assets, that's what they'll be, and you'll all be better off. The Hightower Radio Lowdown is brought to you by the Lowdown Happy Hour, live streamed from the Chat and Chew Cafe. Details at HightowerLowdown.org.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
Quick shout out to the BCTGM members out in Aurora, Colorado, who went out on strike today against Nabisco. And again, it's odd how a lot of these snack companies are finally, the workers have had enough of it after having lived through the pandemic. Just on Monday, you had BCTGM members in Portland, Oregon go on strike as well. Same story. I mean, this is an extraordinarily profitable company, especially thanks to the pandemic, wanting to pay poverty wages, but worse, wanting to close places down and move them to Mexico. In fact, they've closed two places, the one in Fairlawn, New Jersey, which is where I looked for all the Oreos. So it looks like I'm never going to have an Oreo again. And also one in Atlanta, Georgia. Good on you guys for going on strike. Hold them accountable. I do like Oreos, so I hope they're going to make them in the U.S. Anyway, here to share some thoughts on maybe a little of this, but more importantly, that thing that went on in Kansas with Frito-Lay and all the stories around that. I've asked Jordan Zacharin to come talk with us. Jordan is a media producer there at More Perfect Union. You can check out their website, perfectunion.us. Jordan, thanks for taking time for us.
Thanks for having me on again, Rick.
So I'm looking at these, you know, in a time when there haven't been two strikes back to back in many places that I've seen, we're now looking at a lot of places going on strike in this moment.
Yeah, you know, it's like they said now, workers, despite not the minimum wage not rising, the Democrats messed up on that. They broke that promise. Workers have more leverage than they have in a very long time, and they are taking advantage of it, both in terms of demanding better wages and getting higher wages. And now, like, the average pay is $15 an hour, which is pretty incredible. But then also people who are at factories, who are at warehouses, people who have been without contracts for many years, finally going out on strike and, you know, asserting themselves. And it's really great to see. And, you know, it's not every strike is going to win big concessions, but the fact is they're doing it. And that makes a huge difference.
Yeah. And look, you know, the reality is these guys are just trying to save their jobs. I mean, one of the things that Mondelez is trying to do is trying to move everything from the U.S. Down to Mexico. I mean, they closed that plant in Chicago years ago, which is where I got involved with check the label on the Oreo bag. Now they've closed Fairlawn, New Jersey, where they told me this is where we're going to make them. And they, you know, they closed Atlanta. Now they're talking about these. I may never eat another Oreo again.
Yeah, you know, it's what you realize is how many companies and how many brands these giant international companies own. You know, we did Mondelez owns so many snacks, crackers, everything. You know, they were with Kraft for a long time. They have that brand. And, you know, we're going to talk about Frito-Lay, and they are owned by PepsiCo, and they own just about every single thing you go to the grocery store for. It's, you know, a small sacrifice, but getting harder and harder to find a food that is not made by a multinational conglomerate that abuses its workers.
Yeah. Well, let's talk about the Frito-Lay strike. I got to be honest. I know I've been on strike myself. I know how difficult it is. I know the struggles that come along with it. It was a 3-week long strike, as I remember, which is, you know, you start getting into that, things start to hurt. But I gotta tell you, I don't think they got enough. You know, the fact that you went down from working 84 hours down to 72, I don't know that that's a great victory. I mean, a little bit. Tell me I'm wrong.
You know, I think approving the contract was definitely contentious. You know, within the union, they spent a while debating it, and I think it was a matter of people starting to cross the picket line. You know, people were starting to go back to work, which is always tough. It makes it hard. And, you know, a lot of the people were older folks who, you know, still had, who had a few years for retirement. You know, they wanted to just get through it. And, you know, I think that, you know, they had not struck there for like 20 plus years. And I think that this was, you know, unfortunately a time where they had, you know, the union, they don't have a great deal compared to a lot of the other unions. You know, Teamsters is the better, in Ohio has a better deal than them. So, yeah, they were working 12 hours a day, 7 days a week. A lot of times people said they worked five straight months without a day off, just brutal conditions. And, you know, seeing photos from inside and talking to people who are inside, just the safety conditions are just appalling. No, they did not get nearly enough. I think that, you know, it goes to show that Kansas is a really tough place to strike. You know, it's very much a right to work state. I hate that term, but right to work. And it's become, you know, it was tough for them. And I think that the union maybe had, I don't think they were prepared for the amount of attention that was going to come for the strike and the amount of support they would have gotten nationally. The stuff they got, the contract they got, was the same thing that was offered by Frito-Lay at the outset of the strike. And so they would have had to wait a lot longer. You know, speaking with some people there, they got a 2-year contract, and I think there was a lot of people who were upset about it. I think a lot of people weren't able to vote because the hours that they were allowed to vote. And in 2 years from now, it may come that there's a bunch of younger workers there that are more willing to stand alone.
Yeah. Now, one of the guys, you guys, you know, exposed a story there that's gotten an awful lot of attention. This worker, Brandon Ingram, his name was. He was a Frito-Lay worker, somebody who was just doing his job, went over to push a dock plate button, and ended up getting, you know, almost electrocuted. They take him. They take him to the hospital, probably the wrong hospital. You know, almost an hour away, which companies do. And then it's this horror story, of you know, just big bad company trying to crush this guy who wants nothing more than to be able to say, hey, you know, I need to support my family.
Yeah, this guy Brandon, you know, I got to know his family pretty well, and he was a young Navy vet. He was, you know, working at Frito-Lay for years, and he had worked there, I think, for like 6 years at that point. His cousin worked there, his friends worked there, you know, all toiling under, this is in St. Louis, toiling under pretty rough conditions, but, you know, they made the best of it, and he was moving up at the company. And like you said, he hits a button, gets just electric shock throughout his body. And, you know, this had been, another guy told me recently, this button had been broken time and time again. You know, this had been a problem. They had loose wires there all the time. They used to just stamp them down with their feet. This was a known hazard, and he hits the button, you know, is gets the electric volts all throughout his body. It takes him 45 minutes to a company doctor, no, not the doctor, not the, he says they passed four hospitals on the way there. And, you know, they said, oh, you're fine. Not a big deal. His body just starts shutting down, right? Like, he's got just pains everywhere, and they battle him on what short-term disability he can have. Finally, he's able to get out, do that, but they will not pay for any of his medical bills. You know, he ends up with, electric shock. It's not like he broke his leg and, you know, smashed into a bunch of places. This thing had long-term consequences, changed the way his body worked. He starts having bulging discs in his back or in his neck, you know. That was a big deal. His esophagus had problems in his neck there and his jaw. He's got liver disease, which can happen with an electrocution, you know. So it wasn't – this all happened because he was hurt there. But they were able to raise these doubts that, oh, you know, it wasn't like a crane fell on him and broke his leg in half. And so they battle him. Sedgwick, the insurance company, which is infamous for doing this, they don't want to give anybody any money or any comp, follow him and his family. His wife, who's great in the video, if you guys see it, Melissa, she was a star of the show. She was in tears. They homeschool their kids now because they are being so constantly followed. We had lots of video, and we only put a little bit of it in the video we did, but of them just following them everywhere he went to try and say, oh, hey, look, you're walking with a cane, but why are you carrying this bag of groceries, you know? And it's just been this ongoing battle for him, and they will not settle. They will not give him, you know, they're trying to give him workers' comp for just a few years, but I mean, this guy's back, his body has just been decimated, and they do not want to give him a fair settlement.
No, and the sad thing is, and as horrible as this story is, and it is horrible, this is the reality for hundreds of thousands, if not a million workers in this country every year. The fact that these big companies have such power, such control, and in a lot of states, especially Republican-leaning, Republican-governed states, they've gone after and destroyed workers' compensation law. I know where I'm at in Pennsylvania. Every chance they get, they try and make it worse. And they've done a good job of making workers' comp worse in this state. I can't imagine what they've gotten away with in a state like Kansas.
Yeah, you know, they have to have independent, they're Missouri, and independent medical boards, right? And medical exams, and that's a doctor generally paid by the insurance company or the employer. They've got, if you happen to have a, you know, medical exam board, they happen to have oftentimes a lot of nomination, a lot of people, a lot of members who also work for companies separately. So it's a very, very slanted system. It's a very terrible system. A lot of companies now just don't pay into workers' comp, generally speaking, and they don't have that kind of insurance anymore. And so that's happening in states like Oklahoma and Texas. And yeah, it's a disaster of a system. It's something we've been focusing on. You know, it's the fact that companies like Sedgwick, the insurance company, can just follow these people. They're allowed to film them because they're allowed to say, oh, you know, they want evidence that they could be committing fraud. It's the same thing with voter fraud, right? Trying to convict people of who are just trying to live their lives, trying to, you know, make it through the day, trying to convict them of fraud when it's really the big companies are doing things like that. So it's a real disaster of a system. And like you said, it's so unfortunate that happens so often. You know, we got an influx of emails from folks that went through the same thing, whether they work for a postal service, FedEx, other places, you know, people coming up to them and saying, why are you doing this? Why are you carrying that? Why are you walking this way? And then running away, you know, when they have a camera or something like that.
Or worse yet, they set them up by giving them free stuff. We've seen, I've heard stories of sting operations where, hey, you won this. All you have to do is pick this up off the ground and walk away with it. All kinds of stupid stuff that they get away with.
Yeah, it's really terrible. And there's so often so little based on the way the system is and just the way, like, you know, it's tough to get a, you're going to go up against a bunch of corporate lawyers, insurance lawyers, and you have one workers' comp lawyer who's doing his best or doing their best. It's often a David versus Goliath situation.
Yeah, I know. Now, how are they doing now? I mean, this guy's got, you know, lifelong disabilities. When I watch the video, I'm going, you know, this is horribly tragic for any working person. But like I said, I actually know people who have gone through some of this stuff, and the money doesn't make it better. A couple of bucks isn't going to change this guy's life. He was injured on the job through their fault, and they're skating away from it. And I got to wonder, did they ever fix the button?
That I don't know, because he didn't last long at the job after that. You know, they tried to make him come back and just couldn't get through it. You know, I've kept in touch with the family since we came out the video. I think they were pretty overwhelmed. You know, no one was listening to them, and that's the thing. You know, these stories are a dime a dozen, but no one listens to them. And so I think by putting it out there, hopefully, you know, more people, more of the stuff comes to attention. The outrage that we saw at Frito-Lay for just this one little incident, not little incident, but this one singular incident, you know, it got a lot of national attention. I think they're a little overwhelmed, but you know, they started to go fund me, you know, that we put the link out to. Didn't do much other than that, but we put up the link out to it. Over $140,000 people donated to them. Like, thousands of people chipped in. And again, like you said, does not fix what happened. They've been living with this hell in the last 4 years. He's permanently, you know, busted up his body. You know, he won't be able to do the same thing. I mean, this is a guy who's fit. He was a Navy vet. He was in his 30s. This is not going to bring everything back. His wife is now the sole breadwinner, and they raised all this money for her to start her own business or grow her small business that she's been trying to grow. And, you know, hopefully they can find some peace. You know, I don't know, you know, at Frito-Lay is, and they put out a statement, Frito-Lay, kind of a vague sort of evasive statement trying to get rid of the blame for themselves. But You know, hopefully a judge sees this. Hopefully it helps them in that way. But, you know, at least they, I think, you know, being heard and getting some justice and having some that way and having people chip in and try and help them get back on their feet. You know, again, it's small compared to what's going to happen, you know, for the rest of his life and the kind of disabilities he's going to deal with. But hopefully, you know, there's a happy ending.
Yeah. And what's amazing to me is, you know, these big, powerful corporations, the rich and powerful, they always get to tell their side of things. They always get to tell their story. The rest of us, we struggle to be heard. And if it's not for organizations like More Perfect Union, if it's not for the work that you guys are doing, if it's not for, you know, programs like this, those stories never get told.
You know, what's amazing to me is that that's so true. And there's such brand loyalty, which is, you know, kind of a poisonous word. But for the most part, people were really responsive and in a good way to this video. But, you know, there's still people that are saying, oh, you know, like, he could be lying, or how do we know it's true? Or, you know, why would the company do that to him? And there's been a mass brainwashing, you know, this, you know, setting each other, people against each other on behalf of these giant corporations. So, yeah. You know,
And the thing is, you know, it's one of those things where, you know, we want to believe the system's fair. We want to believe that in the event something happens, we'll be protected. And if we look at a story like this, it's got to be an outlier because the system that we believe in has to work. And I go, look, it doesn't. It's broken from top to bottom because, much like you pointed out, you've got a Republican state, a Republican governor. They've moved through and they've destroyed workers' comp, and they put their appointees on that board. It is a seriously tilted thing because, look, Republicans are against, and I hate making this as political and as simple and as cut and dry as it is, but it's been the Republicans who have been doing everything they can do to destroy the social safety net in this country, and workers' comp is part of that social safety net.
I mean, it's a huge part of it. If, you know, it's not just that you get a reward for being hurt, like you're the rest of your life, you know, for this guy like Brandon. Now, some people, you know, they break their leg and they get some money to break up for the time they weren't at work. But a guy like Brandon, his life has changed. And, you know, like you said, people want to believe the system is fair. They want to believe when they eat Oreos, they're not doing anything wrong because, you know, they probably work for a big corporation that gives them a hell of a time. And everyone's pretty beaten down. But, you know, it's hopefully bringing these stories to light. You know, it's justice for one family, hopefully, you know, giving them some compensation and, you know, some, you know, having people listen to them. But hopefully it leads to more and more people coming forward, more and more people believing it's the case and, you know, demanding big companies take action.
Yeah. And look, I'm hoping these stories, by telling these stories and talking about these strikes and these conditions that these workers are struggling under. Because look, Nabisco, Frito-Lay, PepsiCo, these are Mondelez. These are big companies. Wildly profitable CEOs, you know, lining their pockets, you know, nickel and diming these people literally in some cases to death.
Yeah. Mondelez made $3.55 billion last year. They are trying to change the overtime scheme for the workers at the American factories. They want to make it so that they don't get overtime after 8 hours in a day. They have to hit a certain amount of time per week, you know, so they're trying to make people work longer shifts and then, you know, let them off without giving them overtime. They're trying to get rid of their regular weekends off.
And you know, the thing that's amazing to me, you know, if we learned our history in this country, we literally had people who died to get the 8-hour workday. And I grew up at a time where, you know, the 8-hour day was almost sacrosanct. And there was no question that you got overtime after 8 hours. And now you got these big companies who are, you know, it's now everybody's after 40 hours unless you have a union. Or now they're still, they've been trying for years to change it to where, well, let's go to what, 160 hours a month. So you can work 160 hours in 1 week and you can get the rest of the month off. I mean, it's crazy what we've allowed them to get away with.
Yeah. And, you know, there's, until now, there hasn't been much leverage workers have. And, you know, hopefully that, you know, I know the job market is going to be tightening up a little bit, but hopefully over the next bunch of months and, you know, hopefully with the PRO Act, get some of the elements of that in the reconciliation bill. Hopefully that does a bit of help as well.
Yeah, the website perfectunion.us. Tons of stories there. Good video stuff. You guys do really fantastic work, high quality stuff. I love it. I hope you'll come back and share some more of this with us and keep us up to date on what's going on with this guy and if there's any way we can help.
Absolutely, will do. Thanks so much, Rick.
Jordan, I appreciate the time. Again, make sure you check out the website, perfectunion.us. We'll get links out on social media on how you can do that. I'd love to hear your thoughts. Have you ever had a situation where you got hurt on the job? Did it go like this? I'd love to hear your thoughts. Rick@TheRickSmithShow.com. Quick break. Right back. Stick around.
Saving work in America, one show at a time. The Rick Smith Show.
I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in Two. On this day in labor history, the year was 1955. That was the day Teamsters organizer, 28-year-old William Grammy, was kidnapped and beaten. Grammy had arrived in Sebastopol, California, to help organize about 350 workers in local canneries, drying plants, and fruit sheds. The Teamsters had been on campaign footing for months in an attempt to win union recognition, higher wages, better working conditions, and benefits. They had lost a union representation election the previous fall after Sebastopol apple growers moved quickly to lay off union supporters. By January, cannery workers at Oscar Hall & Sons voted for union representation. The workers at Barlow Company would vote against the union just 2 months later. But by early August, the strike wave hit. Workers walked off the job at the Sebastopol Cooperative Cannery. More at seven other area canneries joined them on strike in the days that followed. Grammy would later testify that he had heard reports weeks earlier of a grower threatening to have him killed within 3 hours should any strike actually take place. During the strike that would ultimately prove victorious, three men kidnapped Grammy outside the union's hall. He was driven along a rural road, tied to a pole, gagged, and beaten with a bicycle chain. Left for dead, he was found the next day and hospitalized immediately. But the union and the strikers remained undeterred. Before the strike was over, scab trucks attempting to haul apples to market were vandalized and burned, and scab drivers were beaten. 8 months later, the apple industry finally came to the negotiating table. By May of 1956, apple growers signed with the Teamsters. Labor History in Two brought to you by the Illinois Labor History Society and The Rick Smith Show. For more information, go to laborhistoryin2.com, like us on Facebook, and follow us on the Twitters at Labor History in Two.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So, according to the commissioner of the Chicago Department of Public Health, the Lollapalooza event they had was not a super spreader event. They're claiming that the four-day festival that began on July 29th has not shown to be a super spreader event. In fact, I think they said there have only been 203 cases that have been identified in the 2 weeks since the festival began. And evidently that includes numbers of people who were diagnosed with COVID on or after attending the festival. And my mind goes to this spot of this is going to be an interesting moment. Because I'm waiting to see what happens to the people who right now are attending Bike Week in Sturgis. In a couple weeks when that's over, what will we see come out of that? Will we see a massive spreader event where people are taking it all over the country like we saw last year? And then will that mean that vaccines worked? That, you know, I'm going to assume that more people in Chicago who are attending Lollapalooza were vaccinated than what we're going to see at Bike Week. Just kind of throwing that out there as a thought. It's going to be interesting to see how it plays out, though, because these huge events, the potential is there. Now, you know, we're taking tomorrow off the show because I've promised my kids I'm going to take them to see Green Day in concert. We bought these tickets 2 years ago. You know, they've been waiting for this day. I'm a little leery. I'm a little concerned. You know, we're going to wear the masks. We're going to try and do what we can. But ultimately, you know, we're vaccinated. Going to be interesting to see how this plays out. Now, for me, some interesting news on the investment front. Evidently, Ron DeSantis has rolled out a new treatment plan, I guess, for the state to fight COVID-19. Today, he announced that they're going to start dispensing this Regeneron, the microclonal antibody, whatever this is. They're going to do it through mobile clinics. We're going to get people this Regeneron that's evidently going to help, I guess, if you have it. Not sure. But I got a question whether he bought stock in that company yet. Because, you know, it just seems odd that now they're going to jump out with this. You know, now you may remember, that's the treatment that Regeneron is what Trump got when he got COVID. Now, the claim is that this is supposed to wipe it out. I gotta wonder, and it'll be interesting to see how this works. I also remember it being really freaking expensive. So I wonder who's paying for that when you could have just gotten the vaccine. But like I said, I'm going to want to know if he bought stock in that company. And I guess the other part of it is how it's going to work. Also, Rand Paul. Turns out Rand Paul's wife bought Gilead Science stock some 16 months ago. And now we're just finding out about it. And I had a conversation with a friend today, and he's going, you know, this insider trading stuff, this is crazy. They get away with this, and nobody ever's held accountable. You know, like the woman from Georgia, like a number of other senators, Republican senators who got caught. No real penalties there, were there? No, there weren't. But Rand Paul's wife, I'm going to give Rand Paul a pass on this. I'm going to. One, I understand, you know, paperwork's hard to do, you know, especially when you got the the aqua Buddha. But more importantly, the line in this, that two lines caught my attention. One was, you know, it took 16 months for him to find out from his wife, which I give him a pass, because if you were Rand Paul's wife, would you talk to him? No, so not surprising. The other one that caught my attention was almost to the end of the article. His spokesperson, according to the article, said the senator attended no briefings on COVID-19. So the argument here that she's making is that he can't have any inside information to have used to buy these stocks, because he didn't have any inside information because he didn't show up to any of the briefings. He didn't know anything about it, which then makes me go, well, wait a second. If he didn't show up and he didn't know what was going on and he didn't get the briefings, well, why is he running his mouth again? And don't we pay him? I know, he sent a staffer to do it. It's kind of, I guess the people of Kentucky, I guess you got to think about this. And we're in this moment. We're in this interesting moment where, I always like to think about when we're going through something, I always like to think 100 years out and wonder what people are going to think of the decisions that were made. You know, what's history? What history are we making? When my great-grandchildren look back and go, boy, they were stupid. How could they be so misled? Because we do this, don't we? We look back at history and go, how could they possibly have done that? How could you have been so naive or how stupid? We're living the moment. The question is, do you want to live a positive moment? Do you want the kids to look back and go, boy, they were smart? Or do you want them to go, wow, they were really moronic? Those apples fell way away from the tree. In fact, so far away that they made applesauce out of them. Crazy. It seems to be the only word that I can keep coming up with for why we're in this position. And I just go back to, had we just done right at the beginning what we were supposed to do? And we're in another one of those moments. I don't know. I'd love to hear your thoughts. You can email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. Quick break, right back.
waving the flag of freedom for people, not corporations. Rick Smith.
It is a massive investment, $3.5 trillion to be spent on American families and to combat the climate crisis.
Democrats passed budget reconciliation blueprint, setting the stage for historic climate action. Wildfire smoke reaches North Pole for the first time ever. Plus, Tropical Depression Fred heads to Florida as the rest of the globe swelters.
All of that sweltering and more straight ahead. From BradBlog.com, I'm Brad Friedman.
And I'm Desi Doyen.
Stand by for 6 minutes of independent green news, politics, analysis, and snarky comment.
If Joe Biden really wants $66 billion for trains, he should change Amtrak's name to Track Force.
True that. This is your Green News Report.
Now sign the check, Mitch. Freedom isn't free.
Okay, Desi Doyen, potentially very big news in the U.S. Congress, but of course, extreme weather gets in the way already.
Oh, always it does. First, as we go to air, Tropical Depression Fred is tracking toward Florida, while much of the U.S. is roasting under another extreme heat wave, prompting excessive heat warnings or advisories covering more than 150 million people. In Oregon, Governor Kate Brown has declared a heat emergency just weeks after a deadly heat wave struck the Pacific Northwest. In Europe, still in the grip of a persistent, widespread heat wave fueling record wildfires, the island of Sicily this week, if confirmed, may have set a new all-time highest temperature record for the entire continent of at least 120 degrees Fahrenheit.
In Sicily.
Tunisia on Wednesday also set a new all-time national record of 122 degrees Fahrenheit.
In Tunisia.
In Siberia, also in the grip of an intense heat wave, massive wildfires in that one single region are now bigger than all of the world's other fires combined.
Well done, Siberia.
Worse, smoke from those fires has reached the North Pole for the first time in recorded history, according to satellite observations. Black soot from the wildfires sadly settles on Arctic ice, absorbing the sun's heat, which accelerates the melting of the ice.
Santa is not going to like that at all.
Now, a new dire UN climate report issued this week warns that global warming and extreme weather disasters will worsen and intensify over the next 20 to 30 years, and that the window is closing for world governments to enact swift changes to have a decent chance of staving off truly catastrophic impacts projected for the latter half of this century. To that end,
after years and years of Infrastructure Week, we're on the cusp of an infrastructure decade.
After months of negotiations, Senate Democrats this week passed two major bills. First was the $1.2 trillion bipartisan infrastructure deal, which focuses on repairing the nation's crumbling infrastructure, with 19 Republicans voting in favor. If it's passed by the House, this modest bill would be the biggest investment in traditional infrastructure since the interstate highway system decades ago.
And in electric vehicle charging stations, just want to point that out.
Oh, indeed. President Biden emphasized its historic nature.
This bill is going to help make a historic recovery, a long-term boom.
Senate Democrats also this week pushed through a key procedural vote on a budget resolution strictly along party lines that lays the groundwork for the Democrats' only $3.5 trillion budget reconciliation package, funding over 10 years that boosts working families and so-called human infrastructure. The blueprint also contains the bulk of Biden's climate agenda, targeting 100% clean electricity by 2035 and net zero carbon emissions economy-wide by 2050.
Cool.
It has significant investments to speed the transition away from fossil fuels, cut pollution and emissions, and funds repairs and upgrades to adapt the nation's infrastructure for climate resilience. In its present form, it establishes a clean electricity standard, a civilian climate corps jobs program, investments in environmental justice, electrifying buildings, expanding electric vehicles, renewable energy, and more. Final passage in the laborious legislative process would likely come in mid-September with zero Republican votes expected.
But it does appear to be coming as long as, well, Joe Manchin and Kyrsten Sinema decide to play along.
The two bills together would be the biggest infrastructure investment in U.S. history and are widely seen as the last chance for the U.S. to take meaningful climate action for the next decade if Republicans retake Congress in the 2022 midterm elections. In a recent interview on the broadcast, climate scientist Dr. Michael Mann referred to the dire new UN climate report released this week in noting just how crucial it is that the U.S. take action.
Potential for climate policy stands on a knife edge. This is the defining challenge of our time. Catastrophic climate change is here. The science tells us that we have to act now. This is a defining moment in human civilization.
And I don't think that's an overstatement. For much more on all of these stories and the ones we couldn't get to today, check out our website at greennews.bradblog.com. Find, follow, and share us planet-wide on the Facebooks and the Twitters at Green News Report. I'm Brad Friedman.
And I'm Desi Doyen.
And this has been your Green News Report.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
Seems like South Dakota is the ground zero of crazy right now. You've got the bike week at Sturgis, and also you have the big symposium with the MyPillow guy in Sioux Falls. Evidently, the MyPillow guy claims that while he was at the symposium, he was attacked. Somebody beat him up. And, you know, I got to think, this is where my mind goes, and maybe I'm wrong, but my mind got to this place where he got beat up by one of the people who was attending the sham of a, you know, sham fest. Now, we're gonna tell you who the cheating was, and we're going to show you how the cheating was. And then he finally realized that you know, he's been wasting his life following the pillow guy, and you know, Trump actually lost. So basically he found his marbles and then lost them again and beat him senseless. All over the fact that there was nothing out of that symposium. Nothing. There was nothing. There were some fun moments, but nothing on the election. Anyway, here to share some thoughts on the top stories of the day, our good friend, former Ohio Congressman and political analyst, Bob Ney. Bob, thanks for taking time for us.
Well, thank you, Rick.
So did you catch any of the big symposium by the pillow guy?
No, I try to get a good night's sleep.
Do you have a MyPillow?
Without my pillow. No, I don't have my pillow. I'm afraid they put a chip in it. How's that?
Oh.
I'm going to start something.
Maybe that's it. Maybe that's how they've got all these people.
That's it.
They put something in the pillow.
Probably somebody hitting the got mad at the poor quality of the pillow, I don't know. But that whole thing, you know, they came out and they were canceling originally. He was hacked and he's going to let the world know about the evil, but nobody was hospitalized. I don't even know what happened, you know, exactly who hit whom. But I know he's being sued for $1.3 billion by Dominion Voting System. I know that.
Yeah, I know that, and I hope they get all $1.3 billion out of him.
Well, I've got to give Dominion credit. I mean, they just didn't sit back and say, well, you know, we'll just say, oh, they're all wrong. They went after them. I mean, they went after everybody, and I've got to give them credit for that.
No, I've been watching this, and I'm hoping more. I hope we get to see, I hope they uncover the whole thing. There was a story the other, I think it was day before yesterday, that they let out that OAN, that One America News, that one of their mathematician experts was actually just a guy who put swing sets together. I mean, they're literally just taking people to make stuff up with the most bizarre statements, giving them false credentials, and then putting them on the air as though they're experts to say the wildest stuff just to meet the ends of where they're trying to go with their made-up stories.
Right. And they're going to do this in different parts. I mean, it was South Dakota, but they're going to, you know, have them in different parts, I think, of the country.
Yeah, I hope he comes to this neck of the woods. I would I would love to go to one of these just to ask the people, you know, what's wrong with you?
It's more like a, you know, political rally is what it boils down to, because there's no real facts, obviously, that are brought out.
Right.
And then I don't know how he became the, you know, the whole centerpiece. One thing I will
he's got
defend
money.
Him, and I'll, but one thing I will defend him on, anybody that's mad at him, honestly, and I'm totally serious about this, refrain from saying, you know, drug addict. At one point in time, you know, and he was in recovery for drugs. So they can call him crazy, but just, you know, as far as the addiction, that's not what is driving him to do this today, the previous addiction.
Well, let me ask you about that, because, you know, I've thought about this, and I know a number of people who are in recovery who've gone through the process, and it seems to me that they have addictive personalities, like a lot of people.
Alpha.
Yep. And that addiction then manifests itself in another way. So I look at someone like Lindell and I go, okay, he's no longer doing the drug, but he's addicted to something else. And it's this craziness that he's addicted to.
Now, I think that's fair game. I've had, you know, friends of mine have said, well, he's a drug addict. He's in recovery. So I don't think that's, you know, fair game.
No.
But I think what is fair game is, you know, an alpha personality, and he went into something else. You know, I mean, I'm in recovery. I sponsor people in recovery. And, you know, part of the issue, too, is when you, you know, get into recovery and you get clean, et cetera, you have to do what we say is staying in the middle of the boat. Okay? That's the phrase, stay in the middle of the boat. And sometimes people don't, and so his alpha personality, previous, you know, personality of addiction, translates it into having to do something else to be in control, you know, to be in the forefront. So I think you make a great point, a fair point. Sure.
Yeah, I mean, it's one of those things. I've known people throughout the years who,
right,
and I hate to frame it this way, but when they were drinking and when they were doing drugs, they were decent people. They got clean and they just became the most insufferable folks. It's like a former smoker. You can never be around a former smoker.
Well, and that's why you have to have behavioral change. It's beyond stopping.
Right.
You know, you have to have behavioral change. And if you don't, then sometimes you do another outlet, and his outlet is doing symposiums.
Well, I
on, you know, on whatever. Not the pillows, but the fraud.
There you go. He's going to, I think at some point he's going to wake up and regret this whole thing, because he's going to, I think at some point he's, I hope he can realize at some point that, boy, this was, he threw his fortune away for what was a lie.
Right, right.
Sad. Interesting, right. Your neck of the woods, Congressman Warren Davidson. I don't know if you saw his tweet today.
No.
Ohio Congressman Warren Davidson tweeted out, overreaching governments and corporations won't stop trying to impose critical health theory on Americans. That's why we need my vaccine passport prevention act now more than ever. I am predicting that critical health theory will be the new buzzword that they begin to raise money off of, because, hey, you've got those migrants coming across the border, and those black people, they're the ones who are spreading the virus, not the Sturgis, not the unmasked.
No, I didn't know that. It's interesting, though, critical. They're using the title for the teaching of racial issues, and they're tying that because of, you know, the right's opposition to that. That's very interesting what he's doing.
Yeah, no, I mean, I saw that immediately. I'm going, it's that dog whistle.
Right. No, I did not see that.
Yeah, and I'm waiting for them to start sending out fundraising letters on critical health theory. The Democrats and those liberals, they want you to be healthy.
Well, what does he say about the critical health? I mean, I'm trying to follow what he says.
Well, he hasn't said anything. He's pimping his vaccine passport prevention act, which would ban any vaccine passports. Which I guess we're just never going to travel overseas, I guess. Is that how that works?
Right. I mean, you have, again, if anybody traveled way back when in the 80s, for example, you had your yellow little booklet, I think it was 3 pages or whatever, and in there you had, depending on the country you're going to, you know, you would have your malaria or, you know, whatever, would depend on where you're going to. And so we've had those before.
Yeah.
And there's going to be vaccine passports. Now, I'm not saying that you're going to have a vaccine passport to walk into a store, but I think for flights, it's going to become a regular, you know, part of our life. I really do.
Yeah. Because, look, I remember a couple of years ago, well, a number of years ago, it's got to be going back 10, 12, maybe even further. Our friend Ellen Ratner, she was doing trips to
Sudan.
And I had signed up. I said, you know, I'd be willing to go. And when she gave me the list of things that I had to do to get through it, I'm like, yeah, never mind.
Right, exactly. Yeah, like I said, we've had it for years. Now, in his bill, if that bill would pass, it would allow, his bill would allow, it's not going to pass, of course, individuals to sue private companies if anyone attempts to require proof of vaccination. They could sue. Now, part of the problem, you know, he would have, obviously, is that way back when the vaccines first came out, I think it was the National Labor Relations Board, segment of it had that dealt with discrimination, had said it was not discriminatory if the employers had a requirement. So that standard was set a long time back,
right?
You know, with the shots, with the private sector. So his bill would have actually protected private, would allow citizens to sue, I mean, not to protect private companies if they required it.
Just crazy to me. Just crazy. Also, did you see that Trump has called the police officer who shot Ashley Babbitt? He's called him a murderer, and this seems threatening to me. This is one of those things where, you know, I'm concerned. He says we know who he is.
I mean, it's just I can't follow at all why people are jumping aboard, you know, and President Trump, former president himself, because he's now taking his rhetoric, you know, against this police officer and calling him a murderer, and we know who he is. And that's almost a lynch mob mentality. We know who he is. And he had asked at one time, he said, well, he was part of a Democratic security detail. I hate to tell anybody, because I oversaw Capitol Hill Police, we don't have Democratic or Republican security details, period. They could, at one point in time, work for the Speaker. They could go work for the minority leader. I can't recall a case in the 11 years I was there, and I chaired House Administration to oversee the police. I cannot remember one case where anybody came to my office and said that information was passed by a police officer who happened to be then working for somebody of the opposite party because they were assigned to them. So we don't have individual, as Trump tried to say before. See, he tried to say before Democratic police officer, basically, you know, assigned to the Democrats, when it was somebody assigned to the floor security. That didn't work. So now he's come out and he's, you know, saying the murderer. Even for Trump, I can't believe he said that. It's shocking.
Yeah, I understand. Today, 4 years ago today, was the day Heather Heyer was murdered in Charlottesville, Virginia. A guy from Ohio, 20-year-old Nazi from Ohio, ran her over along with 35 other people. Both good people on both sides there. But the guy who was stopping the treasonous woman from breaking in, he's a murderer. And what's interesting to me is, from what I've heard from my sources, is that the police officer is a black guy. And I fear that this is part of this, you know, you use lynch mob, this kind of ramping up the rhetoric to the point to where it now becomes a black-white thing, instead of this woman was breaking the law. This woman was feet away from doing their, you know, breaking into their mission of stopping that election from being certified.
Well, here's the point, too, for this. If former President Trump understood the Capitol, you know, this would be comparable to to somehow people getting through the gates of the White House. They are not through security. They enter the White House. No one knows if they have a weapon or not. And let me ask this question. What do you think would have happened if that scenario had happened when Trump was president and people came through the fence? They don't know if they had weapons or not, and they got into the door of the White House. What does anybody think would have happened?
Well, Trump would have invited him in for tea. They'd have given him some KFC.
No, I'm talking about people against him.
They'd have shot him dead on the spot.
They would have shot all of them with automatic weapons instantly. And the woman who got killed was breaching the door, and when you go through that door, you immediately turn right, and there's a door, and you're on the floor of the house. And if they had weapons, they could shoot anybody there on the floor. So they're lucky, actually, to be honest with you, that they were walking and running through the Capitol without being shot. Lucky.
Yeah.
But if you get towards the floor of the house, you are putting yourself in a situation where you justifiably can be shot, period. Yeah. And that's why the Justice Department looked this over and said, the officer did nothing wrong. Once that happened, you know, to now say, well, who is he and what's his name and he's a murderer is absolutely just despicable.
But here's the thing, and this is what's frustrating to me is we had talked about this a while ago, and I said, look, I'm surprised that nobody's leaked his name already. So clearly Trump knows, and I actually know some people who claim to know who it is as well. That's one of those really kind of scary things that eventually someone could find out who this person is and do horrible things to him.
Mm-hmm. Oh, correct. You know, in July, back in July, to a call-in that Trump did, he called Babbitt, I think she was a wonderful young woman.
Yeah.
She went to a peaceful protest. The fact they were in there with the zip ties and he wanted to hang the vice president and shoot the speaker, and the fact that the riot was, you know, peaceful, and that the person who shot her in the head was security for a high official, a Democrat. So they took that tone back in July, and again, like I said, it didn't work. So now it's because everybody knows you don't. They're not assigned permanently to Democrat or Republican, and then he takes the tact of the murderer, and it's unbelievable. It's dangerous.
Yeah, but you say unbelievable, but we lived through 4 years of this. I mean, you know, when Heather Heyer was killed, it was good people on both sides, so nothing anymore surprises me.
Well, that's true. That's true. I just don't know how, you know, if he was in the, again, I'll put it in other terms. If he was in the White House as President of the United States and people were coming in there and they had, you know, injured White House security people, Secret Service, and they had injured him and they breached the front door of the White House, they would have been shot with automatic weapons one after the other.
So why weren't they?
And we all know that.
Why weren't they? Why were the Capitol Police so restrained in this?
You know, I'm not out there anymore. But if I was out there and still chaired House Administration, you know, I directly oversaw the police, I would ask the same question. When the shooter came through the south side entrance to the building that day, and he shot Officer Gibson eventually down through the corridor, was there any question about people shooting him? No, they shot him.
Yeah.
They tried to shoot him right away because, you know, they're breaching the Capitol, and again, you know, do they have weapons? Of course some of those people had weapons. I'm shocked that when they just started up the steps that a few weren't gunned down. I'm surprised at that.
And why do you think that is? I mean, you know...
I don't know. You know, it's funny you asked me that question, because I have asked myself that, you know, tons of times. Of why you know, force wasn't used, because you just can't breach the Capitol with the members of Congress and the staff, the Vice President of the United States in there like that. You just can't do it. And I don't know of any other situation where they wouldn't have, you know, taken full force.
Yeah, because
somebody made a call.
My original thought, and I said this, you know, the day of. is the reason that there wasn't more shooting by the Capitol Police is because they feared they were outgunned. They were definitely outnumbered, and they feared that they were outgunned.
Because that would have, in the end, by the way, and I know people say, well, that's just not right, but it would have been justifiable shootings if they had done that.
Yeah.
It would, I guarantee you, it would have been deemed justifiable.
And, you know, the interesting thing is, and this is where, you know, now it's spinning around in my head, this would have been a very high deterrent because the people who are generally the gun folks are the ones who, well, if you go in there and use overwhelming force, they'll never do it again. Had you wiped half of them out, no one would ever do that again.
Right. Well, exactly. Well, it would stop them advancing, too. And that's not shooting into an unarmed crowd or something. If they're actually heading to the door, trying to break through the windows, it would have been a justifiable shooting.
Yeah.
They let them go. Then when they got to the floor, they had to do something. We have Capitol Hill police are stationed out there with automatic weapons. And I can remember two members of Congress coming to me at the time, one Democrat and one Republican, saying, you know, they can't have automatic weapons. We don't like the view of it. You know, it doesn't look good. And I said, well, if somebody runs up here with an automatic weapon, what do you want them to do? Have a revolver to counter them? You know, this is the era and the times we live in. And we have those officers stationed for a reason with automatic weapons, and it's if in case somebody tries to breach the Capitol.
Yeah.
Because they will. Anybody's been in the Capitol knows the Capitol well. You know, there's not necessarily a whole lot of places you can just immediately go to. It's like a labyrinth, but people can go downstairs and follow them in the tunnels. It's really not a place where, you know, you can just go hide somewhere automatically.
Yeah. No, it's just an interesting day for me, the juxtaposition of, you know, Heather Heyer, who was run down by the Nazi from Ohio, and Trump saying that, you know, this was, that she was murdered, that this Ashley Babbitt was murdered and trying to make a martyr out of her.
That was a terrible statement. Absolutely terrible.
Terrible. Bob, I appreciate the time. As always, great stuff.
Thank you.
Good stuff. Our good friend Bob Ney. Seriously, I mean, that's where my mind goes in this place where, look, she shouldn't have been in there. And I fear for this officer who did his job because Trump's toying with him and with the base and getting them riled up. It's crazy. Sad stuff. Evidently, some breaking news today. Evidently, a Republican strategist and campaign manager, this Anton Lazzaro, evidently was indicted today on 5 counts of sex trafficking and 3 counts of obstruction of justice. Here we have, for our QAnon listeners, we have found the pedophiles. They are firmly in the Republican Party. Here is one of them, evidently. But there's a bunch of them. You go back to Mark Foley, the congressman who was, you know, had the underage boys. You go to Denny Hastert, who, you know, went, I guess, just got out of prison not too long ago for fiddling around with underage boys. Jim Jordan, who was accused of looking the other way when those Ohio State wrestlers and athletes were being assaulted. I mean, the list goes on. Roy Moore, you know, it's crazy. The guy who's running against Liz Cheney, you know, knocked up a 14-year-old. You know, and of course Joel Greenberg and his pleading guilty, which I keep coming back to. When does Matt Gaetz get arrested? I gotta throw that in there. He's still there. But now here you got this guy, this Lazzaro. Seems to be a pattern here. And for all the Q folks, maybe you might want to go down that rabbit hole. Just kind of a thought. Anyway, if you missed any of today's program, thericksmithshow.com. That's where you go to get the podcast, The Rick Smith Show app on the smartphone. Take the program on the go wherever you go. And as always, you can email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. Thanks so much for tuning in. We'll see you back here next time.
You've been listening to The Rick Smith Show. Email Rick. Rick@thericksmithshow.com. Until next time, this has been The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.